I've got a bird. Yes. That's a red cockatoo feather. Okay, so here we go. Okay, thank you for your teaching. It is as light as a feather. Okay, very good. That must be from the bird. Dear Ajahn, my poor little mouse has been diagnosed with self-mutilation syndrome by the vet. He bites his own bum and makes it bleed. You already put a blessing on him and his mutilation of his face has since improved. He's on painkillers now. What else can be done for the poor little fellow? My poor little mouse. Okay. What else can be done for the poor little fellow? Well, first of all, keep him away from the cat. And sometimes we have little pets, little pet mouse. Self-mutilation mouse. Hey, hang on. How can you mutilate its face? How can a mouse eat its own face? Oh, scratching it. Okay. We can put little gloves on its hands so it can't wash its face. And he's on painkillers. Well, it's only a little mouse, so I won't take many painkillers. Make it so. Why does he mutilate its face? Is there a mirror in its cage? He thinks it doesn't look good. I don't know. Anyway, what else can be done for the poor little fellow? If it's scratching its face, sometimes that see a mouse psychologist. I know there was. Is it still in the kitchen about the squirrel? The squirrel who went to see the psychologist? Yeah. It's still there, is it? Yeah. Okay, you know that. Have you seen it? The squirrel went to see the psychologist. What are you doing here? And the squirrel said to the therapist, "Well, ever since I realized you are what you eat, I realized I was nuts." So that's what happens when you are what you hear. Anyway, he bites his own. How can he bite his own bum? Listen, stop teaching him yoga. Because that makes you bend all over the place, and I don't know. Anyway, if it's really true and if he's really mutilating itself, I'm not quite sure why. But loving kindness, give it a bigger cage to run around in. I don't know, see if that mouse can be a bit more happy. I remember looking after a mouse in Thailand and clean its cage, and it was one morning, it was really excited, and because a snake had crawled in through the small openings in the mesh of its enclosure, but that mouse was just really a sort of strong mouse, and the mouse actually killed the snake. It managed to bite it and just kill the snake. It was just really, really a very, very tough mouse. And then afterwards, after a while, that it just escaped. And I don't know what it escaped for. It had really good food, a very safety, always nice monks looking after it. But then it wanted to explore the forest, and of course it would have got killed very quickly. Anyway, the poor little mouse. May the little mouse get reborn, if it does die, eventually will do. May get reborn in like mouse heaven. What would mouse heaven be like? I don't know, mouse heaven. No cats, obviously. Lots of cheese. Maybe mouse heaven is being born on the moon, which is made of cheese. I don't know, I better go on to the next question, be serious. My understanding is that karma and its results are personal. If so, how can we share merit? Or is it more than a wish in the Loving Kindness Sutta? okay, it is personal, but it's so sometimes that, I've slipped over and broken my leg. What should I do? Should I say, oh, this is personal, I shouldn't go and fix this up because it's my karma? That would be interfering with the law of karma if I go and call an ambulance and get myself fixed up. I mean, that's ridiculous. It's your good karma, it's your bad karma to have slipped over and broken your leg, but it's your good karma to have a hospital next close by with all the modern resources so you can fix up your leg. So you've been an idiot not to use those resources and go and do something. And it's the same if you, your karma maybe from a past life, your karma of your parents, say, whose their past life was this life and now they're dead, and you start to look at them and think about them and say, well, I'm going to just let my mum and dad just work through their karma. I'm not going to help them out. And of course, that doesn't make any sense at all. It's their good karma, your parents, they had a son or a daughter like you so that you can go and help them. So karma is just personal in one way, but it's also because that you had all your relations, all your sort of good stuff, so make use of that. So we can share our karma. I've been sharing my good karma with you for the last 3 or 4 days. So if it's personal, then you should look after your own enlightenment. But anyway, so how can we share merit? There's many ways of sharing merit, just who you are and how you behave. Your kindness, your generosity, you know, your smile to someone when they're not feeling so well. So all of that is actually wonderful good karma. You're sharing the merits because who you are. And sometimes people don't need to even give talks. Some nuns, they haven't given many talks yet, but they've been sharing their merits with you just by their very existence. They are fully ordained nuns. And they're peaceful and they're here. That inspires you. So their merit of going forth and becoming fully ordained women, then their merit is shared with you. You get inspired. And when it gets to sharing of merits with your relations, like in traditional Buddhism, how can that work? May my mum, my dad, or my sister, or someone who's passed away, may they have a very good rebirth. How can that work? And there was this phenomena, which many of you know, that you have a relation or a loved one on the other side of the world, say in New York, something happens to them, you know. Something's up. You can feel it. So, you know, you get a telephone call soon or you call them and there's been some accident or something. And a classic case of that was when I was visiting Melbourne. It was in the Melbourne Age newspaper. It was a wonderful article. A very well-known vet in Melbourne was going away to a country house somewhere in, you know, maybe a couple of hours from Melbourne, and to a weekend party. And they spend the weekend with his friends. And he was in his car driving along some freeway somewhere, some motorway, and halfway on the journey, he wrote that he was overcome by this really strange emotion. He started crying and weeping for no reason at all. And so it was so bad, he just couldn't focus on the road. His water was coming out of his eyes. He had to pull over into the emergency lane. And just, you know, what he said was just to somehow deal with this incredible grief and get his act together so he could drive to the house. It took him a long while to settle his emotions down, and where this came from he didn't know until he reached his destination, where there was an urgent call waiting for him. His dog had been hit by a car and killed. Back in Melbourne, maybe 60 kilometres away from him, at the precise moment when he felt this terrible sadness. And 60 kilometres distance, there's no way he could know that his dog had died. But it did, exactly at that point. And of course, that's many people have had experiences like that, when somebody close to you has either passed away suddenly or has had some accidents or some misfortune. It may be in Penang, it may be just in New York. You feel it. Something's up. And it's true. There is a connection between you and your loved ones, even if it's a dog, a cat, a little mouse. You can feel it. So that connection is what people use for what we call in Buddhism the transference of merits. It's someone close to you. And so there's still that connection there. So when you think of them, they sort of know. And I've done this experiment before here. I don't usually do it these days, but when we do the loving kindness meditation at the end of the retreat, may all beings be happy and well. By that time, your meditation power is really building up. And you get some really strong mindfulness, you can focus. And I really get into it at the end of the retreat. And then I ask you to send your loving kindness to someone really close to you. Not here, maybe over in England or over in sort of Sri Lanka somewhere. You focus on them and you really blast them with loving kindness. Imagine them and just really give it everything you've got. And you've got your eyes closed when this is happening, but I look at the clock, the time, and take a note of the time. And then once it's all finished, I ask you, say, okay, you know, that person you really zapped with loving kindness, you did that at 12 minutes past 8, you know, on Monday evening. And then I ask you, when you go home, just, well, maybe when it's convenient for you, give them a call. And just talk to them about, oh, you know, just what's going on in life. And then at the right moment, just ask, oh, just by the way, where were you and what you were doing at 8 minutes past 12? Or, sorry, 12 minutes past 8 on Monday evening. And I invite people to do that. And the reason I don't do it now, because then I get all the calls in the evening or emails. Ajahn Brahm, it worked. It's amazing. I called my sort of mum over in Singapore. And she said, oh, that's really weird. I was really thinking about you at that time. It does connect. So when somebody's dead, what we're doing, we just sometimes, this has certainly happened to me. When my father passed away, I thought there's so many things unsaid, which I should have said. When somebody dies, you think, I wish I could just say a few more words. So that's what you do. Funeral ceremony, or afterwards, you know, Dad, thank you for all the kind teachings and all the love you showed me. I really did love you, cared for you. And may my love, my care, my gratitude go with you. I share the merits of my life with you. And you really focus on that, without any doubt, and then you find it reaches them. So that's how we share merits. It's very difficult to share merits with people we're not close to. Sometimes we can, but it's really easy when it's somebody, you know, you spent a long time with. Beautiful thing to do. Dear Ajahn, I find it hard to be myself and love all of me. How can I be self-confident and cultivate non-self at the same time? Hard to be myself. Well, who else are you going to be if it's not you? So the easiest thing is to be who you are. It's pretty obvious. So hard to be yourself means you're always worried what other people think of you, and you're always, you know, just almost like being controlled by other people, like you're just a puppet in the hands of other people and just trying to please them and do what they want you to do. And so to be yourself in the sense of just be relaxed in your own skin and love all of you. If you can't love all of you, we have exercises. The first exercise to love yourself. Hands out, like this, follow what I'm doing. And as you put your hands out, follow exactly what I'm doing. You bring them in. Come on, get into it. Really do it properly. Ooh. Now that's really a good practice. Number one, if you try and hug somebody else, number one, you might get a letter from the lawyer next week. Number two, you might catch some disease. And oh, just you can't hug people these days. Otherwise, you don't know what's going to happen. So, but at least you can always hug yourself. That is not abuse. It's not sort of uninvited. So you know, it must be consensual, hugging yourself. And you don't catch anything you haven't already got. So it's wonderful. It's so easy. So that's sometimes hugging yourself. And you can do it and just really get into it. And you think, this is stupid. Yes, other people might think it's stupid, but it actually works. And you're actually expressing some love towards yourself. And self-confident. The way to be self-confident. Great meditation teacher. Some of the things he taught me was just simple things. He noticed when I was a student that I was really miserable. Believe it or not. And I said, well, you know, I know the reason why is because, you know, you're tired. And, you know, you're sort of struggling and, you know, you've got all these things. You've got to balance your studies and just your social life and everything else. And so he told me, he said, well, I want you to do, when you get up in the morning, when you go to the bathroom, I want you to look in the mirror and smile at yourself. At which point I said, sir, I'm a student, I was drinking at that time, and when I get up in the morning, I'd be afraid to look at myself in the mirror that time of the morning. You know, these ridiculous colleges you used to go to, the students, you know, we didn't have a students' union for the whole university. Every college had a students, you know, a students' committee. And so, you know, it's only all male college in theory. It was in the 60s. Your girlfriends used to come in overnight. You know, I'm sorry, but that happened in those days, the 60s. And so the poor girlfriends, they didn't have any breakfast because they weren't allowed in the breakfast rooms. So the student union there decided to push the envelope a little bit and say, can we have permission for women to come in to the cottage for breakfast in the morning? They're already there. And of course, everybody knew what was going on, but they had to sort of keep up appearances and traditions. So the answer came back from the professors, the dons who ran the college, the fellows. And the reply was, your request has been refused on the grounds that gentlemen do not look their best that time of the morning. That's what they said. Gentlemen like me never look their best any time of the day. But anyway, just they had a sense of humour as well, which was nice. But what he said to me, he said, well, if you can't smile at yourself in the mirror in the morning because you're tired or you just got a hangover or you do... He said, the two fingers, side of the mouth, he said, and push up. And, you know, one of the good things of, you know, being young and being a bit stupid, you'll try anything. You know, you're experimenting. And so I tried that. For 2 years, I was smiling at myself in the mirror every morning. I don't think I missed any day. Just in the mirror. And I saw this stupid young man smiling himself. And of course, my smile got broader. And I ended up honestly laughing at myself every morning for 2 years, first thing in the day. What a wonderful thing that was. And yeah, all these meditation and yoga or health food and stuff, but whatever. That is so cheap, so easy. Anyone can do that. And it works. And sometimes, you know, that after you smile so much, you know, you get stuck in that position, which is not a bad place. And that makes you self-confident. Because actually, the confident people like you. people like to be around smarty people. Who likes to be around someone who's miserable? Would you like to be around Mr. Trump? That's the main reason why many people leave the White House. Not that they get sacked, because they want to go. I'll make a lot of this up. No evidence at all. But would you like to be around someone who's really miserable? They just bring you down. You're happy and people like to be around you. So that's how you get your confidence from. How do you cultivate non-self? You do that in your meditation. You can be anyone you want. And so the confidence of non-self. This is one of those Nasruddin stories, one of my favorite ones. Nasruddin was this Muslim Sufi. And, you know, it's just, when you sort of read him, I wish there was more Muslims like Nasruddin. He was really, really fun. Nasruddin, he was, you know, they did a meditation retreat for his students. And after it was all finished, you know, to celebrate, they said, okay, I'm going to treat you all. Now let's go to the fair in the local town and have some nice food and, you know, my expense. And then when he went into the fair, there was this stall where you had three arrows. You got to get the targets. And if you hit the middle of the target, you get like a teddy bear and a prize. So he said, oh, yes, I'll have a go at this. And they never realized that, you know, their master could do archery. They never knew he could do that, never heard he could do that. And the reason was because he couldn't. But he had a go, you know, it's just shooting an arrow, how hard can that be? And he was soon to find out. He just put the arrow in the bow, aimed at the target, pulled the arrow, let it go, and it only went halfway to the target. You know, it didn't make the distance, not even near the distance. And, you know, he was embarrassing his students. You know, really respected him and said, no, okay, come on, you can't do this. So just, let's get out of here. He said, no. That was the shot of a hasty man. I rushed it. So he took the second arrow. He had 3 hours. He took this one. He took his time on this shot. He pulled it right back and further back and really bending that arrow. And he let the arrow go. And it went a long way. It made the distance, but about, you know, 100 meters to the right. Almost killed somebody. At which point they realized, look, you can't shoot the arrow. People were looking at him and giggling. He was making a fool of himself. And then the teacher said, oh, well, that was a shot of a conceited man. An arrogant man. And then the next day I said, let's get out of here quick. You're going to kill somebody. We're going to get fined. You can't do this. You never trained at all. But this master insisted. And so he pulled the arrow back and shot the arrow. And of course, it went right in the center of the bull. And as he was choosing his teddy bear, he won the prize. His students couldn't believe that. They were so shocked. And I said, how'd you do that? He said, if the first shot was a shot of a hasty man, and the second shot was a shot of a conceited man, who was that third shot? And Nasruddin said, oh, that was me. Oh, I like that one. That's how you cultivate non-self. You know, all the times you fail, that wasn't you. When you get it right, that's confidence. That was me. You play around a bit. So, during meditation, I noticed that there is an option to let the mind be, not control it, and just observe it. I noticed that there is another observing mind that watches the thoughts and then decides to engage with some of those thoughts. Is this right? Who or what is the observing mind? The observing mind. If you follow the thoughts and get lost, that was just the stupid mind. That's not you. But if you can follow the silence and get into jhana, yeah, that's you. Know that sometimes that we have choices, so experiment. Sometimes it's just trial and error. Let's see if this works. Let's see if that works. And you get the feedback. So don't always do it the same way. Because if you do, like in life, sometimes if we always turn the same direction, because that's what our teacher said, it's not what your teacher said, it's what you thought the teacher said. It's what you understood the book to say. But it doesn't work. And after a while, you find out, you know, the teacher may be very wise, but what you interpret from the teacher is not exactly what the teacher said. And of course, then it goes into your ears and it gets changed a bit. By the time you remember, that's not what the teacher said. It's something totally different. Okay, here we go. Another Ajahn Brahm story. The old monks don't lie story. Who hasn't heard old monks don't lie story? Okay. Doesn't matter, I was going to tell it anyway. So this was on the rains retreat. Before the rains retreat, this old monk was walking, you know, not having any place to stay. A really good monk who would just wander everywhere with his bowl and robe, just like a bird, going for alms food. And then, so one day, he came to the house of a poor farmer, and a poor farmer just was a Buddhist, and so offered him the alms food. And at the end of offering his alms food, the poor farmer said to the monk, he said, "Oh, you know, have you got anywhere to spend the rains retreat yet, the 3 months?" And he said, "Actually, no." He said, "Oh, please, Venerable, come and stay with me. There's a nice meadow by the river, really quiet. I can build you a simple hut, no problem at all, because monks, you know, don't need mansions. It's very simple. And all I would ask is you come to my house. We'll make sure you're well fed, because we have our own monk for 3 months. And all I'd ask you," he said, "you know, help us with our meditation. Now, teach us some Dhamma, inspire us, and maybe once a week sort of teach our kids how to be good kids." And the monk said, "Okay." So the farmer built a very simple hut, didn't take that long, and the monk sat there and meditated for 3 months, and he'd come to the house every day for alms food, give a nice bit of advice to the family and to the kids, and even the dog just got to love this dear old monk. He was just such a beautiful character and so wise and kind. So they got quite attached to this monk. So after the 3 months, the last day of the rains retreat, the old monk went to the house and said, "Tomorrow I have to leave. It's the end of the retreat." A witch, even though the farmer should have known, he went onto the ground and he cried, "Oh, please, monk, don't go." And the wife started wailing too. "No, I don't mind cooking for you. Is something wrong with my food? Please stay." And the children started crying because they loved this little monk, old monk. And even the dog started whining. I don't know if that's what dogs do, but that's the best I can do because I'm not a dog. And so the whole family were really devastated. But the monk said, "Listen, sort of in my meditations, I have had really good samadhi, very deep meditation. And in my meditation, I've noticed, using my powers, that not far from here, closer than you think, there's a buried treasure. Huge amounts of gold, which were buried a long time ago, very close. And I want you to have it, so you don't have to live in poverty anymore." And they all got a bit interested then. And so he said, "But you have to follow my instructions to the letter, perfectly." I said, "What's the instructions?" And even the dog looked up. And he said, "In the morning, you have to stand in the threshold of the doorway of your poor hut. Take up that bow and arrow you have for hunting. And in the morning, wait and it for the rising sun. Face that rising sun. And as the sun, the orb of the sun, starts to rise above the horizon, point the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. And just at that moment when the orb of the sun separates from the horizon, let the arrow fly. Where the arrow falls, that's where you'll find the treasure. Guaranteed," said the old monk, "because old monks don't lie." So they were missing this monk, but they still thought tomorrow they'd get the big treasure. So they were up really early in the morning. And the farmer couldn't wait for the sun to rise. And when the sun started rising, he picked up his bow and arrow. He stood in the doorway of the house, facing the rising sun. And as the sun started to rise, he pointed the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. And as the sun separated from the horizon, he shot the arrow, went a long way. And the whole family, the farmer, his wife, the two children and the dog, raced after that arrow. When they found it, they dug a really deep hole. But you know what they found? Nothing, only trouble. Because a lawyer came by. He said, "What are you doing digging in my field? That is illegal. You cannot do that. I am going to sue you, all of you, including the dog." And the farmer said, "Look, it's not my fault. An old monk said we find a treasure here." And the lawyer said, "Did you say old monk? Because I'm a Buddhist too," said the lawyer. "And old monks don't lie. So what did he tell you?" And they told him the instructions. He said, "Ah, I know your problem there. You didn't follow the instructions properly, because how can you shoot a bow and arrow? You're just a poor farmer. You need to be a lawyer, smart, to be able to fire a bow and arrow." So he said, "I'll make a deal with you. Well, I will shoot the arrow tomorrow morning," said the lawyer. "And we'll split the money, 51%, 49% to you, and less my fees and stamp duty and other sort of out-of-pocket expenses." And he quickly wrote up a contract, which he made everybody sign, including the dog with the paw print. Please, I apologize, any lawyers here. And so the following morning, the lawyer was there with a bow and arrow. At the door, he faced the rising sun, standing on the doorway of the little hut. And as the sun rose, he pointed the bow and arrow in the direction of the sun, and as the sun separated from the horizon, he shot the arrow, and it went much further. Because, you know, he was not as poor as the poor farmer, but better fed. And where it fell, they all ran after it. The lawyer, the farmer, his wife, the two kids, and the dog. And where it landed, they dug a big hole. And what did they find? Nothing, only more trouble. Because coming past was a general with his troops, his soldiers. And the general said, "What are you doing? This is my land. You cannot dig in other people's land." And the lawyer said, "Oh, yes, we can. Let's take it to court." And the general said, "No, soldiers, cut off their head," including the dog's head as well. And then the lawyer said, no, wait a moment. Old monk said we find a treasure here." And at that, the general said, "Hold your swords, soldiers. Did you say old monk?" He said, "Yes." And the general said, "I'm a Buddhist too." Now, don't ask me why he was ordering people to, his soldiers, to cut their heads off. That's just a detail, okay? And I'm inconvenient sort of detail, as Mr. Gore used to say. So, he said, what did the old monk say? And when they gave the instructions, you're stupid lawyers, farmers, all of you. What does a layperson know about shooting a bow and arrow? You have to be a professional archer like me. I've trained in the military. I know to shoot a bow and arrow. He said, "Tomorrow morning, we'll go to the farmer's house, and I'll shoot the arrow," said the soldier, the general. "And we'll split it three ways. No need for a contract. We'll just split it up three ways." And so the following morning, the general was there with the lawyer, with the farmer, his wife, the children, and the dog. So that morning, they waited and waited, and as the sun rose, the general stood in the doorway of the house, faced the rising sun, picked up the bow and arrow, and as the sun separated from the horizon, he shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun. He went a huge distance. He was a professional. He spent his whole lifetime training every day in archery. And so they all ran after it, the general, the lawyer, the farmer, his wife, the two children, and the dog. Where it landed, they dug a huge hole. And what did they find? Nothing, only real trouble this time. Because the arrow had fallen in a garden belonging to His Majesty the King. And the royal soldiers, the royal guard, arrested a lot of them, including the dog, and presented them before His Majesty the King. And His Majesty the King, first of all, looked at the general. He said, "You're one of my best generals. I'd have expected much better from you. Greed has made you break the law. Lawyer as well. There's nothing we can do. Destroying royal property is a penalty carrying the death sentence. Even though I would rather not, I have to be fair and apply the law. You will all be executed, including you, dog." And the dog thought it was very unfair, but that's life. And at which point, the general said, "Sire, I was told that where that arrow would fall, where we dug, we'd find a huge treasure." And he said, "Well, who said that?" "This old Buddhist monk." And at that, the king said, "Did you say old monk?" He said, "Yes, because old monks don't lie. I'm a Buddhist," said the king. He said, "What did the old monk say?" And when they repeated the instructions, the king couldn't understand why, following the old monk's instructions, they hadn't found any treasure. So he was interested, because old monks don't lie. What's going on? So he said, "Look, I'm going to suspend the death penalty for a week, put it on hold until I find that monk, find out, you know, what's behind all of this." So he put everybody in prison, and then he looked after them. The dog had good food, and everyone else was comfortable, while they sent other soldiers out to find the old monk. They soon found him and brought him back to the palace, and the king had everybody, the dog up to the general and the old monk, and said, "Venerable sir, I'm surprised at you, that you've got these poor people and even one of my best generals in big trouble. Why did you do that?" And the old monk said, "Because they never followed my instructions, Your Majesty." "What do you mean?" said His Majesty the King. And the monk said, "Your Majesty, I won't explain it to you, I will show you. Please come to the poor man's hut tomorrow morning, before dawn, and I guarantee you will find an immense treasure there. I'd only ask you to please share it four ways equally, and even a king's share. That would delight your treasury. Just imagine just how much wealth that would give, and a quarter of it to the poor farmer and his family." And the king was interested. He said, "Okay, yeah, I want to find out what these people did wrong." So that following morning, the king was there, together with the general, the lawyer, the farmer, his wife, the two children, and most importantly, the dog. Never forget the dog. The insignificant ones are sometimes really important to the story, but actually not in this case. So the king stood there just as the sun was about to rise, and stood in the doorway of the house. He looked back at the monk and said, "Monk, correct, Your Majesty." He picked up the bow and arrow and pointed it in the direction of the rising sun. "Correct, Your Majesty." And just as the sun was about to depart from the horizon, he pointed the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. "Correct, Your Majesty." And just as the sun was about to separate from the horizon, he was about to shoot the arrow, when the monk said, "Wrong, Your Majesty. I never said shoot the arrow. I said let the arrow fly." And the king thought, contemplated, and he understood. He didn't shoot the arrow, he let it go. And it flew straight down between his feet. And there they dug a very shallow hole and found an immense treasure. It was so immense that when they shared it out four ways, the king was really happy. but imagine the poor farmer's family never needed to farm again. And even the two children went to these elite schools, Eton and Harrow in England. And even the dog managed to get an air-conditioned kennel with little butlers to serve him his favourite food. But it wasn't just the wealth, because the old monk explained, it's not just the money. When we shoot the arrow of craving, over here, over there, what do we find? Nothing, only trouble. When we want wealth, good family, health, we want respect and fame, we want to pay off all our debts, even when we want nimittas or jhana or so on. We shoot the arrow over here, shoot the arrow over there, and what do we find? Nothing, only trouble. When we let the arrow fly, it falls right where we are right now, between our feet. We let the arrow of craving go. And there you find the immense treasure. You're standing on it right now. You're sitting on it. I don't mean go to the workshop and dig a big hole in our beautiful bamboo floor. But where you are, that's where you find a treasure greater than your wildest dreams. And that was said by an old monk. And the story was relayed to you by an old monk. That's why I know it's true. Because old monks don't lie. And you know that story. That was actually from the Iranian poet Rumi. Somebody actually found it because someone told me at an airport once, and I always wondered where that was from. The fakir and the fakir was the name they gave for the monk and the farmer or something. It's a famous story from Rumi. Showed that even in those days they knew about Buddhist monks over there. Anyway, there we go. So let the mind be and not control it. Let it, the arrow fly. Let your mind go. And where it goes, it falls, right where you are, that you will find the greatest of treasures, peace. Anyway, actually, how do I find out who I was in past lives? And if I find out, what does it mean to this life? If you could give example of yourself or someone you know, that would be much appreciated. Okay, just one of the, there's all sorts of really amazing stories of past lives, but one of those ones, how many people, you know, who grew up in England here, in UK? Only you? Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Do you remember there was a comedian on TV called Roy Hudd? You've heard his name before? Roy Hudd. Huddy. And anyway, he was a household name in UK when I was growing up. But he never really made it outside of UK, never went into movies or anything. But he was in London. He was just finished a performance at one of the theatres. And he was driving home in London at night time. And the government had just put in a new one-way system. And he got completely lost. You know, he couldn't go his normal way home. And so he got lost and he was wandering around in his car, driving this way and driving that way. And he turned a corner and he said in the article he wrote that just, you know, the goosebumps all over his back of his neck. Because he remembered the street. It was where he lived in his previous life. And it just, memories flashed back in front of him. And as he drove to his old house and in London. Sometimes you do have these little blue circular plaques, whatever it is, which tell who lived there before. And on that house was one of the circular plaques, because in his previous life, he was, what's his name again? Dan Leno, D-A-N, surname L-E-N-O. who was one of the most famous music hall entertainers in the 1910s, 1920s. And this was now in the 1960s. He said, that was me before. He was an entertainer before, one of the most famous ones of the time. So he had this little plaque on the wall. And so he knocked on the house, on the door of the house. And of course, you know, if it's an ordinary person, they say, who you are? No, thank you, not today. And so, but they, hey, you're Roy Hudd, what are you doing here? And he said, I used to live here. No, you didn't. We've been here since, you know, before the Second World War. I was here earlier. That was me. And he took them all over the house. And they were just amazed that he showed them where he would do his rehearsals, the changes in the building, you know, the renovations and stuff, all 100% accurate. And he never got anything out of this except for trouble, because he was contracted, I think, to the, had two channels in those days, BBC and ITV, I think it was. He was contracted to the ITV, and the head of the ITV was a very staunch Catholic. And as soon as the head read that article claiming he was Dan Leno before, he got the sack. That was the end of his career. But what he did do, he wrote many books on music halls, and especially on biography of Dan Leno. He was the expert. He should be the expert, because it was him in the previous life. He sacrificed his career for that, because of truth, that was him. And he was a comedian in his past life. He was a comedian in this life. So maybe you can speculate who I was. But anyway, what that really was interesting was, you know, it was somebody who sacrificed a lot to, you know, to explain his previous life. And it was with lots and lots of evidence, you know, which was very convincing, that must have been him. But also his character, his personality in a previous life was so similar to his personality in this life. An entertainer in a previous life and an entertainer in this life. That's really fascinating. So that's actually what happens. So when you get to a previous life, if you do get to a previous life, it explains a lot. You know, sometimes, you know, the little idiosyncrasies, what you get attracted towards, there's a reason for that. And so you find out, yeah, that was, understands a lot. That was me. Anyway, we spoke about spiritual materialism or wanting. How do we know when we are being wise versus we are being materialistic, etc.? Meditation, I want to come back to the breath. You will find that's not the way to get back to the breath. Wanting. So if you let the breath come to you, tomorrow I promised I would talk about what happens when you meditate, you really let go. The breath comes to you. And that's always the best. To these days, I never go looking for the breath. Because if I do, it's like I'm capturing something and it's not the right time. And it's just, it's always uncomfortable. It's never as easy as when I just sit and be really peaceful. And after a while, things disappear and all you've got left is the breath. And it's always just so easy and very pleasant from the very beginning when I let the breath come to me. So we're being materialistic. It's actually, you're not really knowing how this works. You let go of everything, and then the breath comes. Or sleep, I want to sleep more, nap, etc. You just lay down. You feel, you ask the body, mind, how are you? After a while, you get to know your body. I mean, how long have you been living with it now? Don't you know when it needs a sleep and when it doesn't need a sleep? And you trust it. You don't think, oh, I have to sleep 6 hours a night or 8 hours a night or 10 hours a night. Ask your body what it wants. There are times when you don't need much sleep at all. Sometimes you really need a lot of sleep, especially if you've got some sickness or disease coming. And that's what I've been doing that for years, that sometimes you just, you know, you've slept well that night before, and then you get up and you start doing stuff and you think, hang on, my body is just, you know, needs a rest. And I check it out and said, yeah, I need a rest. no logic behind it. You know, as far as I haven't slept much last night, I've had a disturbed sleep. No, my body says, no, you need more rest. And I know it's true because I go back to my room, if I possibly can, lay down, you're out like a light. You don't have to sort of force yourself to go to sleep. It's like the body said, great, thanks, we're out of here. And just when you wake up, hour and a half, you feel so amazing, so wonderful, really full of energy. Because you've listened to your body, and you followed the body's advice, and it works. And you feel, you know, whatever it was, could be some flu virus or something else, and you've nipped it in the bud, you've got it first. And the body, while you're asleep, it's been relaxing, resting, and healing it up. So that's the sleep. And lastly, eating in general. I want to have eat something more. Again, it's the same, that after a while you can experiment, try eating more, try eating less. And after a while you learn, just no, this is the right amount today for me. And it's never the same. You know, sometimes you eat a lot and I eat some more and I'm still hungry. I have some more. Another time you just eat a little bit and say, that's enough for today. Because your body is giving you the warnings, the instructions. I read this book once about people who have heart attacks. And the doctors, the neurologists or whatever, say, oh, people say it just came out of the blue, totally unexpected. He said, that's Go Ma Young. He never said Go Ma Young, he said something else. But Go Ma Young is a Pali word. He didn't know Pali, but he knew about hearts. And he was saying that your heart gives you many warnings, many, many warnings before the big one hits. And most of the time, people just out of fear or denial, whatever it is, or mostly because they're too busy, they're looking somewhere else, they don't catch the early signs. And they just ignore them until eventually the big one comes. And he said, that's one of the reasons why when you are aware of your body, sometimes you know, hang on, there's something wrong there. It's not normal, you can feel a little whatever. And then you can take the proper action. So that's what happens with the being aware of your body. And it's not materialism, it's not indulgence, it's just wisdom. Hi, Hindus often talk about the God of merging in oneness with the cosmic consciousness. Is there any merit of all to this idea of oneness and merging from a Buddhist perspective? You start with oneness. Well, first you start with diversity, and then you go to oneness, and then you go to nonness. You can't go further than the nun. No, it's true that sometimes the one. So I'm sometimes a bit cheeky, well, actually, most times. So I was with a friend who was a Christian. That's right, I think it was in Malaysia somewhere. And then, you know, we were just friends and friendly banter. And then he thought that he got me. And he said, you know, Ajahn Brahm, there's nothing higher than God. And I looked at him and said, I agree with you. Absolutely. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Nothing is higher than God. And he looked at me and he said, nothing, emptiness, the void. Is higher than your God. That's not what I meant, Ajahn Brahm. I can be very sneaky at times. There's one of the fellows here. I think when does KC Wong come? I think it's on Wednesdays, isn't it? Or something. He goes around saying, praise the Lord! Praise the Lord! Buddha. He was teasing people. But anyway, that's actually the even more than one is none. Nothing is higher than the one. Dear Ajahn Brahm, the recent mindfulness conference you attended in Perth in late September, attracted some very high-profile people, really, who are highly educated and experienced with mindfulness. I didn't know that. They're just people to people. You know, once I I went, no, so to John Barter's place, you know, it's one of Metaji's mates. And it's just a meditation. But this was in really top part of Sydney. Was it Double Bay or something? And so I just went in there just teaching some meditation. And this girl, maybe about 30 or 40, you know, she's looking at me and smiling. And, you know, just meditating, smiling. And, you know, I was a little bit sort of concerned, but, you know, I'm pretty safe smiling at me, you know, quite a nice blonde girl. And then afterwards, I asked her, who the heck was that? She was making all these faces at me. She was really upset at you. I said, why? I think because she was a famous TV actress. Was it Rebecca Gibney or somebody? He said, yeah. Everybody else knows who she is, but I don't watch TV, so I didn't. So she was trying to say, hey, I'm Rebecca Gibney. And I say, who the hell's that? That's why she got upset, because I didn't recognize her. She's a famous TV actress, like a household name in Australia, but I don't know. Well, anyway, there we go. So anyway, Mutra Mindfulness Conference, was Rebecca Gibney there as well? Who else was it? I don't know. Was scientifically speaking, what were their findings? Did you learn anything from the so-called professionals on this subject? Not really. I know that sometimes professionals, you know, just when they sort of talk about mindfulness, they're just so scientific, so dull. After a while, I've been to many conferences, teaching at conferences, and one of the problems is you talk at a conference and you just tell people what they already know. They could get that out of a book or get on YouTube or internet, they can find the information. So I want something a bit more engaging. So that's why, that, you know, you tell a few jokes, a few funny stories, you really get them into it, challenge them a little bit. So that's one of the most important things. That's why I do go to many conferences. One of those conferences I went to recently was in Korea. Is that actually 3 years ago now? 2015, World Computer Congress in Daejeon. I was a keynote speaker. You know, a keynote speaker is, you know, you get the sort of the head of the organization, the mayor of the city of Daejeon, and then the keynote speaker to set the tone for the whole conference. And that was really cool because they thought, Ajahn Brahm, we didn't know you were into IT or, you know, computer stuff. I said, I don't. So what are you doing here? Telling all these big execs from Google and LG and who else? Obviously Samsung. And I said, well, I'm here because they actually offered me a business class ticket, and I think it's a couple of $1,000s. And it's a really nice hotel, transport everywhere, and a really nice donation afterwards. I think was it $3,000 for our monastery, just for, you know, just going to Daejeon and just saying what I didn't know, winging it. But no, I knew a lot about things like innovation. So one of the things I said there, I'll bring it up now, because people say, where's your insight practice, Ajahn Brahm? We just talk about meditation. What about insight? What is investigation, contemplation? And they had a bottle of water there, and so I held it up and said, what is this? To all these delegates. And of course, they didn't know where I was going, but they're like, come on, what is this? And they said, well, it's a bottle of water. What else? It's plastic. What else is it? Well, it's sort of cylindrical with tapering at the top with the blue plastic. What else is it? What else is it? What else is it? And I kept on pushing them until they ran out of names. I said, once you've run out of names and descriptions, then you might be able to see what this is. Because I'm talking about innovation. We think in such a narrow range, limited just by words and labels. And you see this, and the first thing you say, bottle of water, and you think you've captured it, you've finished with it, so you don't look any more. But I pushed you to keep on looking, keep on exploring, go beyond all of your words, which is your old knowledge, what you've been taught, to name things, classify things, put them in boxes. Go beyond. until you look at this and you run out of labels. And that's where innovation starts. That's really cool, because they hadn't read that in a book. That hadn't been on YouTube in a scientific journal. It was something which you see things from a different angle. That's where innovation comes from. And I told the story of the ice cream cone. You know ice cream cones? You know where that came from? The St. Louis World's Fair. 1920 or something. And it was just chance that on the World's Fair they had stalls selling food. They're simple stalls. And it was just good fortune that the stall selling ice cream was situated right next to the stall selling waffles. And the two people, you know, for days on end, just, you know, just next to each other, talking with one another, just, you know, discussing things, becoming friends, and say, why don't we combine? So they rolled up a waffle and put ice cream in it. The ice cream cone. Two foods which no one ever thought would go together. They put them together and became our ice cream cone. That's innovation. Buddhist meditation and high tech. What have they got to do with one another? I don't know, let's see. See if you can put them together. So that's actually why you get going to conferences like the mindfulness conference. Of course, they know I know mindfulness, but I was putting humour. Humour and bad jokes. Do you believe your knowledge and understanding goes beyond their theories and surveys? Yeah, because sometimes when you are a monk, you know, you've got freedom to experiment, push boundaries. You're not being paid. Because you're not being paid, you can't be fired. I try to get fired and retire, but you won't let me. That's why that sometimes, that even in government, we were talking, this I think came from Ajahn Sujata, he said many people in government, because they're really concerned with duty of care and litigation and compliance, so that in many parts of government and that sort of area, they are always have a principle of care. But CARE means, it's an acronym, CARE, cover, ask, retain employment. In other words, don't take risks. And we're a risk-averse society. Our kids are risk-averse. We don't explore. And so there's something which is dying in our society, just actually see things from a different way. Anyway, Ajahn Brahm, why are we destroying the planet? Is there a big plan for the meditators? Yes. We're all going to get into jhanas. And when we get into jhanas, then we become indestructible. We are destroying the planet. We try and keep the planet going for as long as possible, but this planet is going to be incinerated anyway when the sun expands. And it's just this, you know, it's very predictable. This sun is going to be expanding so much that it's going to take in the orbit of Mercury. Venus is, Mars. Mars is going to be sort of vaporized, and so is planet Earth. Everything, even those big seed bank in Greenland, Svalbard in the Norwegians are making, that's going to be incinerated as well. All the monuments, every trace of human life and animal life and everything else is going to go into cosmic dust, spread to all parts of the universe. Nothing will remain. I thought that's really cool. Why do people want to preserve things? Why do we want to keep things going? People say, what about keep our genetic line? Look, I've already given up my genetic line. I'm a Darwinian dead end, being a monk. I've had no progeny. My genes will go into dust. I think that's really quite cool. So anyway, that's what's going to happen to us. We just keep it going as long as possible, as best as possible. But why are we destroying the planet? Because of wanting, because of this craving. Dear Vandana Champaran, walking inside on these strips of velvet is so boring. Excellent. You're boring into the nature of reality. So like drilling down, which is what boring is, drilling into the essence of existence. Amazing. Please give us some strategies to make it interesting. Okay. Now, I did this last time in Penang. I'm not going to do it this time. It's usually nun's job. I think you've already done it once, haven't you? Yes, okay. Who's my victim? So who's the most junior here? Nuns. Okay, Ajita. So, we're going to now demonstrate the Australianization of walking meditation. So, you start. I don't ask people to do things I haven't done myself. So, it's called Australian walking meditation, kangaroo style. So, first of all. You are so lucky, Venerable Chokhi, you're not the most junior, otherwise you'd be in big trouble. So. Sorry? Venerable Chokhi. Oh, Chokhi, yeah. So anyway, but you're not the most junior, are you? Actually, how many reigns have you got? Are you more junior?
Me, I'm seminary.
Seminary? You're seminary too, because who's the most junior?
Venerable
Chokhi. Okay, ooh, that's very close. So always keep your mouth shut close, otherwise you get in trouble. Okay, so first of all, the position of your hands. That's right, like a kangaroo. And now, the ordinary walking meditation, you don't just walk left, right. That's just so just ordinary. So how does a kangaroo walk? Mindfully? You hop. And you experience all the sensations as you stand, and then you hop again. And once more, very good, mindfully, the third hop, yay, thank you very much. Do you think that was good? Now you've got to do it. At least once on this retreat, when you're in one of those rooms and other people are there and they're really bored, and they're just depressed, out of kindness, compassion for them, stand on one end and actually put your hands like this and hop from one wall to the next wall, and you find people are looking at you and think you're absolutely crazy. But you're doing that out of compassion and kindness. It brings up energy and all the boredom totally vanishes. So whoever wrote this is so boring. You are obliged to do some kangaroo walking meditation. Yeah, I've done that. I did that in Penang. It was last year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Last December. And I thought, there's no one else to ask, so I did it myself. And then I was doing that, and as soon as I started, all these iPhones came out. Click, 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 click. So anyway, it's nice to actually make people happy and just give people a bit of a boost. Walking outside, how do we make the loveliness of nature a part of meditation? Just look at it and appreciate it. Because the loveliness of nature makes you stop thinking. Oh, my goodness me, I'm never going to get this finished. Are there any living arahats today? And if so, are there just a handful or many? Find out this. I know there's not enough. So we need more. Okay? So that's your job. Yeah, there are living arahats. Could you please explain the difference between samatha, vipassana and bhavana? There's no difference. People think it's all difference. This is Ajahn Chah. He said, the front of the hand, the back of the hand, side of the hand. Now you see the front of the hand, you can't see the back of the hand. Now you see the back of the hand, you can't see the front of the hand. But the back of the hand is there, the front of the hand is right behind. You can't separate them. You can't separate them at all. But you can only see one part, but the other part is falling right behind. Samatha and Vipassana are like that. You can't divide them. So where there's Samatha, there's Vipassana coming right behind. Where there's Vipassana, there's Samatha coming right behind. That's Ajahn Chah Simran, pretty accurate. In cessation of perception and feeling, why consciousness is not mentioned? Because without perception and feeling, there's no consciousness. They're all gone. Even at some time, the word sanya, perception, is sometimes used, like in the Potapada Sutta, as consciousness. So this is when you get so still. The will is body's gone, vanished. The will is gone, and now all of consciousness has turned off. Poof. You're gone. You're gone, baby. You're gone. That's cessation of perception and feeling. Can one or two cessation experiences enough to lead to emptiness? It is emptiness. What is this emptiness? There's nothing there. It's a sutta. Are you trying to make something out of nothing? There's no emptiness there. It's gone, finished. So, try to make something out of nothing. There was a story of Aniruddha. Aniruddha was one of the Buddha's close disciples. He was actually the one who supervised the Buddha's cremation ceremony. And Aniruddha, cousin of the Buddha, and that he, when he was a kid, before he ordained as a monk, Aniruddha had this amazing good karma that whatever he wanted would always appear, and that he would never hear the word, there isn't any, or there's nothing. That was his resolution and great good karma, so he would never hear the word, there's nothing, or there isn't any. And so, he was, as a kid, he was playing marbles with his friends, his other kids, and he kept on losing. And he was betting his lunch, which was some cakes. And so every time he lost all his cakes, he sent his servant, he was a very wealthy young man, sent his servant to get some more cakes from mummy. So he kept on losing all the cakes until the mother ran out of cakes and told the servant, go back to my kid and say there aren't any cakes. And the word for there isn't any is the Pali word is natti, there isn't. So the mother said, natti cakes, there's no cakes left. And so the servant took the basket back with instructions, natty cakes, no more cakes. But because of Aniruddha's karma, which could not be broken, the heavenly beings had to intervene to keep the karmic reward of his previous generosity. So they inserted some heavenly cakes into the basket without the servant's knowledge. And so when the servant came to Aniruddha with the basket, he said, natty cakes, there aren't any cakes. And Aniruddha opened up and it was the most delicious, amazing cakes. It was the heavenly cakes. He said, oh, my mother's never really loved me. Why has she never really given me any of these natty cakes before? Natty cakes are the best. But natty cakes means there's no cakes. And the other simile was Alice through the looking glass or in Wonderland, whatever. But anyway, when she got to the Square of the Red Queen, the Square of the Red Queen, and Alice arrived there. And the queen asked Alice, she said, did you see anyone on the road? Did you? Because I'm expecting my messenger. And Alice said, no, I saw nobody on the road. Did no one pass you? No one passed you. Wow, you've got such good eyes. You saw no one on the road. It's hard enough for me to see somebody, but you could see no one. And no one passed you, which is true, because no one arrived here before you. So, you can tell that sort of Lewis Carroll, who was before, he was Charles Dodson, he was a professor of mathematics. So that's why he played all these tricks with the word nothing. There was nothing there. Then eventually when the messenger arrived, and he said, messenger, why do you take so much time? He said, look, no one runs faster than me. Exactly, because no one arrived here before you. So it's making something out of nothing. And so when we have emptiness, there's nothing there. It's gone. Ah, this nothing must be a wonderful place, like a heaven realm. There's nothing. But well, there has to be something. It's this wonderful heaven called nothing land. Right? Nowhere is the best place to be. So please, give me directions to nowhere. So it's making something out of nothing. That's a problem. In a sutta from emptiness, the mind inclines towards seclusion or nibbana. What does inclines mean? It is you can't stop it. If there's an incline on the road, it just you don't have any effort. It just you roll towards it. You can't stop it. It's leaning towards, inclined towards it. So that's just where you go. One sees the most brilliant, beautiful colours when meditating. What is the Buddhist explanation for this? It's nimittas. And they're brilliant, they're beautiful, amazing. And this is also the prabhasara citta. The citta is the mind, and the nimitta is the sign of the mind. And this is the radiant mind. Brilliant, like a sun, beautiful. Is this the same that people experience when taking drugs like LSD? No. Number one, you don't get into jail by going to see nimittas, and they're much purer. And because they're not chemically induced, they're much more powerful. Ajahn Brahm, what was it, this middle-aged man, he was unfortunately a heroin addict, and he came to monastery because he was trying to get off the heroin addiction. And just really trying her very best to give him a good environment. So, it was cold turkey, but, he was willing to try it. And he was doing really, really well. I don't know, for a month or 5 weeks, I forget how long. And then one day he came to me, and he obviously was putting a lot of letting go into this, because he came and said, look, I had one of these incredible nimittas. And he said, I have to tell you this. He said, that sort of bliss of the nimitta is better than heroin. He said, I never thought I could tell anybody this. Because for me, the reason I'm addicted to heroin was that it was the highest pleasure which I've ever experienced. But, Ajahn Brahm, I've got to give it to you, right? Deep meditations, much higher happiness. He could not maintain it, unfortunately. But so he eventually got back into heroin again. It was really sad. But what he said was just really, amazing, because I'd never taken heroin. He said, yeah, okay, I can understand it's bliss better than sex, or better than orgasm. But I thought no one could ever do more bliss than heroin. He said, yeah, this is. So that's the radiant jitta, the abhasara jitang. And this is the beautiful lights you see. Really incredible joy. Anyway, but don't want it. If you want it, it will never come. During meditation, when I'm calming my body or focusing on body, my breath is automatic. When I try to be aware of mindful, my breath is no more automatic. Very good. I have to forcefully inhale and exhale. After some time, my mind wanders off. Now breath is automatic again. Please explain this. It's because whatever you watch, you interfere with. It's a weird thing that we are such control freaks. If we're watching something, you may be watching somebody cook the lunch. You say, that's not how to do it. I know. And so even in the monastery, there's so many experts. This is how it should be done. And to prove it, the usual little exercise. Now I want you to be aware of the saliva in your throat. A moment ago it was quite comfortable, but now it's irritating. Do not swallow. That doesn't do anything, it's still, It's amazing that when we watch things, we tend to interfere with them. We want to control it. This is part of our sense of ownership. After a few moments, you won't be aware of the saliva anymore and it'll go back to normal. So it's a really important trick in meditation, be able to observe something without interfering with it. To let it be. Stop trying to control the thing. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I have heard two teachers say that it doesn't matter what kind of meditation technique one uses. By the Visuddhimagga states, various meditation objects, techniques suitable for different temperaments, characteristics, traits. Yeah, sort of. That's three teachers you've heard. Visuddhimagga and these two other teachers. Also, that certain teachers emphasize their techniques being more superior than others. There's nothing is better than Ajahn Brahm's techniques. I am the best. There's something that's alarm bells. I've often told people there's nothing more superior in the morning than baked beans. Do you agree with me? It's because I was English and that's what I was brought up on. That's why. So superior, that whole idea is, you know, it's not an absolute. It's, sometimes it's good for you today and something else is good for you tomorrow. So if certain teachers emphasize their techniques being more superior than others, that is so much gold, my young. Having said that, is it okay to assume that any technique, mindfulness of the body, Mahasyanapanasati, regardless of its suitability for the meditator's temperament, would eventually lead all the way to enlightenment, if you let it? But please clarify, elaborate on the matter. There is this nice simile from the Samanyapada Sutta. King Ajatasattu went to see the Buddha in the Bamboo Grove Monastery for the first time. And very simple simile. He went by his chariot, that was his vehicle, as far as a chariot could go. And then he had to get out of his chariot and walk in his sandals, as far as he could walk in his sandals. When he got to the entrance of the hall, he had to take off his sandals and walk barefoot into the hall where the Buddha was sitting. So, every vehicle you can use for a certain time, and then you have to let it go. Different vehicles take you so far, and then you let go. So it's just something like even the breath. The breath can only take you so far. And then you let go of the breath, and you go to nimittas. Nimittas is beautiful lights, they take you so far, then you let them go, and you go into the jhanas. Little by little, vehicles getting more refined as you go deeper into your mind. What is the right motivation to become a monk? Well, it's Ajahn Chah's story, which I heard from his own mouth. He said that one of the reasons he became a monk, only one of them, was that as a small boy playing with his friends in the village, like, you know, sometimes people play house in Western countries, and he used to, sometimes they play football. He used to, his favorite game as a young kid was playing monk. And he would always volunteer to be the monk. And he would sort of get some brown rag and drape it around him. He'd sit on a rock on a high seat, and all his friends would go to their mum and get him things to eat. He said, from that time on, he always liked the idea of being a monk. He had a sense of humour, and it was just really funny when he said stuff like that. What is the right motivation to become a monk? Oh, whatever. Sometimes people become a monk for the wrong motivation. They don't know what they're doing. And they do it for, just see what happens for a year. That's when I became a monk. It's just because I was really into my meditation. I thought, this is really interesting. I want to find, you know, where this meditation leads to. You know, the bliss better than sex. This is fascinating. So I went off to become a monk. I told all my friends, I'll be back in a year or two, because, you know, I wanted to get my enlightenment out of the way, so I could, you know, get on with my career. You know, it's important to get enlightened, but then I've got, you know, many other things to do. That's what I often honestly thought. You know, then, you know, after you come enlightened, go back and get married and start a business or make some money, have some kids. How little did I know? What questions should one ask oneself in thinking about this? Don't ask questions. Follow the Nike method. Just do it. Is there a too old to start this journey? Oh, better late than never. Give it a try. Trouble is, though, that sometimes good monasteries get very popular. Bad monasteries are empty. So sometimes, sometimes you spend your whole life just building monasteries. Well, sometimes that's the case. So you know the Bodhinyana monastery is full. So what do? We buy some more land and build another monastery. And before it's built, it's full. So I don't know what to do. Anyway, see what happens. Well, I actually did think of is because why don't you just bite the bullet and just do it? So we got some land next to the Cambodian centre in Kelmscott. So I thought, look, if I just build a couple of huts, they'll get full up before you know it. So I do know this gentleman. I saw his wife came today to offer food. That's Peggy of John Chan Finbar. And they build big apartment blocks, 20, 30 story apartment blocks. So I thought, let's do that. 30 story, you know, high rise. Because once you've got the high rise there, you know, the bottom story, that's, you know, where people come and bring their food, a big kitchen there. The next level is for, you know, the visitors, you know, who come to do some meditation. The second will be for the Anagarikas. And then the next one will be for the junior monks, the novices. And then the next level for the junior monks, and then the middle monks, and the senior monks. And of course, you know, because this is our tradition, the penthouse, the highest room, has to be for... And of course, above the penthouse, you'll have your helicopter pad. Just like James Bond. You know, sometimes, you know, of course you never do that, but, you know, sometimes... Some monks do. It's crazy stuff. But anyway, you know, you've got to live a simple life. And obviously you have another tower block for the nuns at Dhammasara. You know, just do it once. I mean, so much work getting planning permission, you know, just for some cooties in the forest because of fire. Just go for broke. You only have one building, 20 stories high. Imagine just how many nuns you'd be able to put in there. But don't forget, you know, to have the secret dungeons underneath for the naughty nuns. Underground. Well, the naughty monks as well, I didn't say about that. I have heard one teacher speak of pain simply as energy leaving the body and another that is past sankharas rising to the surface and leaving one. Your thoughts on these? The first teaching of the Buddha was middle way, don't get into pain. The first teaching. You know, he's just going through pain as much as he possibly could and find it never ended. You find that's not the way. That's why the first teaching, he said, middle way, avoid such extremes. But somehow or other, in religion, generally, people always think that to mortify the body is a way to transcend the body. Just don't worry about its pain. I already told you a few stories about that, about the monk who sat all night and had to have a double knee reconstruction, about the monk who went out to Hampstead Heath all night in just three little robes and got sort of a double pneumonia. Or about those... The people still do it in the Philippines on Easter Day. They flog themselves. I mean, they really flog themselves. And they nail themselves to a cross or get someone to nail them to a cross. You know, that's really sick and worrying that people do things like that. And why do people do that for? Because somehow or other we think that pain, no gain. For Buddhism, no bliss, no liberation. Interesting, isn't it? No bliss, no liberation. Okay, bliss and liberation don't rhyme, but pain and gain do. But, you know, that's... And of course... The Buddha taught the breath meditation. What's a breath meditation called in Pali? Anapanasati. The Buddha never taught Anapanasati. Mindfulness along with pain. That's not Buddhist. Is there a mantra in walking meditation similar to breathe in peace, breathe out, let go? Yes. The one we use is the Malaysian Singapore one. You right foot moves, mati. Left foot moves, pasti. Mati, pasti. Mati, pasti. In Thai, dai, ne. Dai, ne. English translation is, as your right foot move, I will die, left foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die. It's not a joke. First of all, I think this is one of Ajahn Brahm's silly silly sort of jokes, but you do that. I will die, that's for sure. You get through the fun part of it and say, hey, this is actually true. I will die. And that's the most certain thing. Then you come across a little bit of fear. I will die, that's for sure. So why are you carrying around all this grief and trauma and anger? Well, other people did what you did. Why are you worried about the future? You're going to die. About the economy, about Wall Street, about the exchange rates. I will die, that's for sure. It almost forces you to let go. So you keep on walking, I will die, that's for sure. I will. It's amazing just how many of your attachments are seen to be trivial and so easy to let go. Otherwise I will die because it's time's coming up. About the jhanas, from beginning to first jhana, is that 1 year, 10 years, next lifetime? Who knows? Is everyone in this hall except me sitting in bliss most of the time? Oh, you've got it, well done. Everybody in the hall except me. Once there's a me, a self, an I, of course you can't sit in bliss. Once you let go of the me, there's no me there, and then bliss is there. So it is everyone except me. If there's a me, no jhana. If you experience a jhana, will you always be able to get back there, or maybe never again until next time? If you experience a jhana, you never think like that anymore. A next time, will I always be able to get there? As long as there's an I sometimes. People ask me, oh, come on, Ajahn Brahm. You know, you're not allowed, but because our rules, you can check the other monks, to say about, you know, any attainments you have. But you can, there's no rule about saying all the things you can't do, and all your mistakes, and all your stupidity. So one day when people said, okay, Ajahn Brahm, come on, come clean, can you achieve jhana? And I say to people, I have to be honest with you. Sincerity is the most important part. Ajahn Brahm can't enter jhana. Ajahn Brahm can't do it. Used to try, but kept on failing. Ajahn Brahm can't enter jhana. Are you shocked? Are you disappointed? Do you want your money back? Ajahn Brahm has to disappear first, and then jhana happens. I, Ajahn Brahm, cannot enter jhana. Ajahn Brahm vanishes, disappears. You're not there anymore. Then jhana happens. Do you get it? One day you'll get it when you vanish. You have to disappear. That identity, Ajahn Brahm, has to, boop, gone. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you gave us lots of wisdom. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Very good. Is that my handwriting? I'll read quickly. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what is the difference between Chaitanya, universal factor, and Sankara, fourth aggregate of wanting? Nothing much. Pretty much the same. Why do arahants bother getting up each morning? Well, they don't. They just, their body gets up. There's no one there. So the body gets up, it's just habit. Out of compassion for the whole world, they get out of bed. As Ajahn is a master meditator who has experienced deep states of meditation, does this give you the ability to speak to and understand animals? Are you a dog whisperer, cat whisperer? If so, can you tell us an interesting talk you've had with an animal? I don't know the story of the dog. This was in Europe, who applied for a position in the European Union Secretariat. They'd advertised for jobs. You know, anyone in Europe knows absolutely no discrimination. You know, if it's any gender or any gender identification, no matter just what LGBTQIAI plus. And, you know, there was fairness for everybody. Age, whatever, race, religion, if you could do the job, you got the job. So one day a dog walked in, and with his paw he pointed to the no discrimination clause. He was applying for a job as a secretary. So they had no choice, they had to give him a try. So they put him on a desk in front of a computer, okay, log on, and write this email. You wouldn't believe this dog, you know, with his paw, he turned on the computer, logged on, opened up Google Mail, put in his password, and he typed it up a perfect email. It's amazing. So next thing, he had to do an Excel sheet, spreadsheet. So he opened up Microsoft Excel, opened it up, and it's perfect. Spreadsheet. It was a miracle, almost. And this dog was just so well trained. So, but the last test, he had to speak a second language. This was Europe. So the dog went meow, meow. That's a stupid joke. Just like it. Conversation with animals. Can you speak to an understand animal? Your dog whisper, cat whisper. If you have a time when you go home, get on the internet and Google in Alex the Parrot. A-L-E-X, the Parrot. It's really spooky to do this because this is real, it's not fake, it's not digitally enhanced or anything. This is a parrot, African grey parrot, who actually died about a few years ago. But his two psychologists who developed a method for teaching human beings who had language deficiencies how to actually start to learn a language and speak. It was developed for children with language sort of difficulties. And so they thought, why don't we try this out with an animal? It was an African grey parrot who sometimes lives, 50, 60 years. And you all maybe heard, parrots say, pieces of eight or whatever, just one or two words, in the zoo. But they tried to teach this parrot a whole vocabulary, a big vocabulary, which they managed to do. And then what the amazing thing was, this parrot would use it intelligently to the point it would have a conversation with people. And it was weird because it had a limited vocabulary but was obviously responding to questions intelligently and speaking back. And this parrot, what convinced me was doing these tasks, trying to prove that it understood the language and, was talking back. And then he was on his perch and he said, I'm bored, I'm not doing any more. It was a parrot with attitude. And it showed it and had so many sort of videos on YouTube of Alex the Parrot. You can look it for yourself. This parrot could speak, could have a conversation with a human being. And it was clear. So you don't need to sort of have psychic powers to teach with to talk with animals. It's quite clear it can be done. Animals can speak sometimes. They can certainly understand. What was that we were talking about just before we came up here? And the guy appeared in heaven. And, it's a Christian joke. And as he appeared in heaven, St. Peter at the pearly gate said, what's your name? And he looked at him and said, in all your life you've never done any good karma at all, so you can't come in here, you have to go to hell. He said, no. Just once I saw this whole gang of Hell's Angels. This whole gang of bikies, really rough, and they were beating a person and because he hadn't paid his drug debts. And I went in there, I intervened to save that poor person. I said, you did that? That took a lot of courage. How many Hell's Angels were there? Oh, there was about a dozen of them, really big, violent people. But I went in there to try and save the person. And he looked in his book and said, I can't see that in my book. Are you making it up? And the guy said, no, because it only happened 2 minutes ago. So, when you talk about animals, oops. Anyway, talking with animals, you tried it. Be careful, I'll be in trouble again. Dear Ajahn Brahm, could you please talk again about free will and free won't, with specific reference to right effort in meditation? Free won't. No, I won't. It's free will and free won't. I decided won't. It's free to do that. That's what it's talking about. That's giving an example. Free will and free won't. Tonight, the answer is, I won't. Sadhu. 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 Okay. I'll probably do it tomorrow. It's getting late. Okay. Have a good night if you won't. You don't have to. Sorry for going on a bit long, but everyone seemed to be enjoying it.